From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. On today's Fresh Air, turning right. William Rehnquist once considered retirement when he was the lone conservative on the Supreme Court. But since he became Supreme Court Chief Justice, four conservative justices have been appointed. We'll talk with journalist David Savage, author of a new book on the making of the Rehnquist Court and the implications for upcoming rulings. Aram Saroyan was writing one-word poems in the 60s. By the 70s, he moved into prose. Coming up, we talk with him about chronicling his own literary life and the life of his father, the late writer William Saroyan. And rock critic Ken Tucker reviews albums from Criss Cross and TLC, two hip-hop groups that are making it big on the charts. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Corva Coleman. Astronauts from the shuttle Endeavour are slowly closing in on a wayward satellite. This is the third and last time that the shuttle crew will try to grab the elusive Intelsat satellite. Three astronauts are now in space. They hope to grab the device with their hands and steady it while a special retrieving bar is attached. If the crew is successful in bringing the satellite back into the Endeavour's cargo bay, they will attach a rocket to the satellite and prepare to send it to a new and higher orbit. The United Nations said today it is pulling most of its civilian staff out of war-torn Sarajevo. Secretary General Boutros Boutros-Ghali said in a report issued today that the recent escalation in fighting there had left the city too dangerous and confused for non-military personnel. NPR's Jim Zaroli reports.
The move comes one day after the European community decided to pull its ceasefire monitors out of Sarajevo, and it is likely to add to the growing sense of pessimism about prospects for peace in the former Yugoslavian republics. In his report, Boutros-Ghali painted a grim picture of life inside the Bosnian capital, saying residents were low on food and were subject to frequent shelling from Serbian forces outside the city. One UN relief convoy trying to travel to Sarajevo had been stopped more than 90 times by roadblocks. Given conditions in Bosnia, Boutros-Ghali said he had ruled out sending peacekeeping troops there. Meanwhile, the Secretary General said there is a renewed dispute between Serbs and Croats over the boundaries for UN-protected areas in Croatia. He said that has raised the possibility that the UN-brokered peace plan in that part of the region could fall apart. At the UN, this is Jim Zaroli reporting.
Western creditors meeting today in Paris decided to withhold $174 million in aid to the southern African country of Malawi, which is being criticized for human rights abuses. From Paris, Lynn Terry reports.
Donor nations meeting under the auspices of the World Bank decided to put Malawi on a six-month probation period. After that, they'll consider further aid packages. For now, only a few countries have agreed to provide food aid to Malawi, which is plagued by a drought. But their commitment of $100 million fell far short of the $270 million Malawi had requested. The donors also refused to pledge aid that is not related to the drought. They said in a statement that they would consider future aid when substantial progress has been made, a reference to the country's human rights record. The government recently jailed a prominent pro-democracy activist. Malawi's president has also been accused of murdering and imprisoning people who oppose him. For National Public Radio, this is Lynn Terry in Paris.
Stock prices moved up on Wall Street today. The Dow gained nearly 7 points to close at 3391.98. Advances and declines finished about even. This is NPR. German television is reporting that disgruntled public sector employees in Germany have overwhelmingly rejected a wage compromise worked out by union leaders with the government. Dieter Berger has more from Frankfurt.
The compromise wage agreement, which would grant salary hikes slightly above the current inflation rate, was reached after 11 days of public sector strikes. But the agreement falls considerably short of union demands, and dissatisfied union members apparently did not approve a ratification of the compromise. The final vote will be announced tomorrow. Union leaders have not yet said if they will try to reopen wage negotiations with the government. Meanwhile, wildcat strikes continue today in the metalworkers and print industries, where wage negotiations have broken down. Numerous newspapers were forced to print shortened strike editions. Union leaders say they will hold a strike vote next week. For National Public Radio, this is Deidre Berger in Frankfurt.
The Los Angeles district attorney says he wants to retry one L.A. police officer on an unresolved charge in the beating of motorist Rodney King. City D.A. Ira Reiner says the decision is up to a judge who will hold a hearing on the matter Friday. Officer Lawrence Powell was acquitted of all but one charge in the incident. The jury deadlocked on a charge of excessive force in the beating. President Bush today doubled to $1.2 billion the amount of federal relief being set aside to help Los Angeles rebuild after the city's riots. In an address today in Baltimore, President Bush also made another plug for his emergency six-point plan for urban renewal nationwide. The package calls for financial incentives to help businesses locate in inner cities and helps public housing tenants purchase homes. The government says retail sales in April were stronger than expected. The Commerce Department says retail sales were up 0.9%. The increase was led by automobile sales, and the agency says this is the third strong gain in 4 months. I'm Corva Coleman, NPR News in Washington.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. The Supreme Court has in the past few years changed direction. Turning Right is the name of a new book about the making of the Rehnquist Supreme Court. My guest is the author, David Savage, who covers the court for the Los Angeles Times. Rehnquist became Chief Justice in 1986, and since then, four new conservative justices have been appointed. Savage writes, "Gone is the court majority that breathed new life into the Bill of Rights, dismantled Southern segregation, disciplined police who violated the rights of citizens, removed religion from the public schools, and swept aside laws forbidding women to end their pregnancies." The Supreme Court will soon hand down its ruling on a Pennsylvania state law restricting a woman's right to abortion. This morning, Savage attended a Senate committee hearing on a bill that could keep abortion legal even if the Supreme Court overturns Roe v. Wade.
Well, the Senate and the House are considering the Freedom of Choice Act, which would allow Congress to protect abortion rights if the Supreme Court should overturn Roe v. Wade this year or next. It would essentially write into national law a provision that says states may not restrict a woman's right to get an abortion before the point of viability of a fetus.
Now, President Bush would likely veto such a bill if it passed.
He certainly would veto it. He said that several times. And I have to say this is, at this point, a way to raise the political issue even higher. The Democrats are planning on, if the court in late June restricts or overturns Roe, to quickly pass this bill about the time of the political conventions in July and August and force the president to veto it. And that would make the issue very clear for the November elections. Governor Clinton has said he would sign such a bill and support it. I believe Ross Perot would support it, and George Bush would not. He would veto it.
This was a Senate committee hearing this morning. What
was the
actual function of today's meeting?
They were holding a hearing on discussing whether this bill was constitutional. There's at least some doubt as to whether Congress has the authority to create a new right. If the Supreme Court says there's no such right, it's not clear that, at least there's some debate on whether Congress can create a new right and say there is this right. The Bush administration has the view that abortion is not covered by the Constitution, and Congress has no ability to intervene in this area. This is a matter for the states to decide.
How does it look to you?
Well, I it's an interesting question. I don't know how it would be. This would become a very significant question should Governor Clinton get elected and Congress would pass this, let's say Congress would pass this law, Clinton would sign it into law, and there would be a national statute on the books that says the states may not restrict the right to abortion. And one of the states could then challenge this in the Supreme Court and say, look, there's nowhere in the Constitution where Congress is given the power to regulate in this area. And so it would be another difficult dispute before the Supreme Court. A conservative Supreme Court could actually strike down a national law creating a right to abortion, and that would be quite an interesting constitutional clash.
Let's get to the subject of your book, The New Supreme Court. You say that the Supreme Court under Rehnquist doesn't see itself as the defender of civil rights and civil liberties, the champion of the individual. Now it sees its duty as upholding the will of the majority. Would you explain that fundamental difference?
Sure. The Supreme Court gets cases usually where someone is coming before the federal court saying, I have a constitutional right to do something. Let's say in this case, and we were talking about abortion, a woman says, I have a fundamental right to choose abortion in some state, for example, Louisiana, Utah, or in the case of the original Roe case, Texas, saying, no, you do not. Abortion is a crime in our state. And so the question for the Supreme Court is, do we act and strike down that law as violating the Constitution, violating a woman's fundamental rights, or do we defer to the lawmakers in the states and say, we will uphold this law and not give force to the individual rights? So almost every constitutional case, you get that situation where an individual is on one side saying, I have a fundamental right to do this, and some aspect of the government, a prosecutor, the police, a state legislature, the federal government saying, no, you don't. This is the power of the government. So it's almost always a clash of the power of the government versus the rights of an individual. The liberal court during the Warren era in the 60s and 70s was much more inclined to read the Bill of Rights broadly and say that individuals have rights of all sorts and that the government may not infringe those rights. The Rehnquist court is now heading the other way, saying we're going to defer to the powers of government, states, city councils, school boards. If a school board would want to impose some sort of prayer or Bible reading in the schools, the Supreme Court would be much more inclined now to say, you may do that. That's a power to be decided by a state legislature or a local school board. It's not a matter of an individual right.
Rehnquist used to be called the Lone Ranger because when he came on the court a little over 20 years ago, he was the lone conservative in a court of moderates and liberals. What gave him the reputation as an extremist then?
He fundamentally disagreed with all sorts of areas of constitutional law that had become accepted. As I mentioned, the separation of church and state principle. He's always disagreed with the criminal rights decisions like the Miranda decision or very strict decisions limiting the police power to search and seize evidence. On the First Amendment, he's been always inclined to say that the government can restrict pornography or all sorts of areas that some of the more liberal members of the court thought were protected under the First Amendment. So during those eras, in the 60s and 70s, he was viewed by at least liberals as an extremist. In fact, I would use the parallel of Ronald Reagan. If you ask somebody in 1965 or 1968 about Ronald Reagan, a lot of people would have said, well, my goodness, he's a nice fellow, but he has very extreme conservative views. Well, by 1980, he was the president of the United States, and at least some people had changed their view of him. Rehnquist was viewed as an extremist in the 60s and early 70s when he first came to the Supreme Court, and he's now the dominant figure on the court, largely because of Ronald Reagan.
A couple of other stands that Rehnquist took that I think might be relevant to that view of him as an extremist is he argued against Brown versus the Board of Education. He opposed the Civil Rights Act of 1964. He's opposed the Equal Rights Amendment. You say that he made the statement that the ERA would turn wedlock into holy deadlock.
Yes, he opposed it. That's when he was an attorney in the Nixon administration. He was opposed to the then pending Equal Rights Amendment. On the 1964 Civil Rights Act, I had recounted a scene in the book in the city of Phoenix where he lived then. He was a 39-year-old attorney. The city council had been somewhat embarrassed the year before, in 1963, that there was a national convention of attorneys there, and one of the premier resort hotels in the city didn't allow Jewish overnight guests. So the Phoenix City Council decided to pass a public accommodations law that said essentially that no person may be restricted in his right to enter motels, hotels, restaurants, drugstores, whatever, because of race, religion, or color. This was several months before Congress passed the 1964 Civil Rights Act. And Rehnquist representing no client, just speaking for himself, went down to the city council one night and said that he thought that was a mistake, that that this was a matter of fundamental freedoms, and that the city council should not try to tell hotel owners or drugstore owners who they can serve and who they cannot serve. He was very concerned about the, as he said, the freedom of the individual. I think it also shows, though, he was not particularly concerned about the freedom of, say, black persons to go to a restaurant or stay overnight in a hotel in Phoenix. And he's had that. Now, I should say, for the record, I don't think he'd take that position today. I think he made clear in his confirmation hearings that he now accepts the fact that the 1964 Civil Rights Act was a good thing and has been a good thing for the country. He certainly accepts the Brown versus Board of Education decision. But in 1952, when he was a young law clerk, he had written memos essentially arguing that the Plessy versus Ferguson decision, which allowed separate but equal and segregation throughout the South, was a longstanding decision and should not be changed now by the Supreme Court.
If you're just joining us, my guest is David Savage. He covers the Supreme Court for the Los Angeles Times, and he's written a new book called Turning Right, The Making of the Rehnquist Supreme Court. We're going to take a short break, and then we'll talk some more. This is Fresh Air. We're talking about the Supreme Court with journalist David Savage, who covers the court for the LA Times. Why do you think Ronald Reagan chose Rehnquist to replace Warren Burger as the Supreme Court Chief Justice?
I think Ronald Reagan knew very little about Chief Justice Rehnquist, but he had at the Justice Department, of course, Attorney General Ed Meese, and Meese had, working for him, a young clerk named, a former Rehnquist clerk named Charles Cooper, who had risen up to be a fairly high official of the Justice Department, and he and Brad Reynolds thought very highly of Rehnquist. Rehnquist was, for that small circle of Washington attorneys who were ardent conservatives and had followed the court very closely for many years, Rehnquist was a real hero, sort of like Robert Bork was to a certain group. They pushed for Rehnquist's nomination. They said he'd be the ideal Chief Justice, and he's been a very successful leader of the court because he's a person of clear views. And also, he's a very likable. He's a very genial, very down-to-earth. He doesn't have any sense of arrogance or pomposity. And it is, after all, a fairly small group. There are nine justices who meet behind closed doors. They work together very closely. And while their job requires sitting around and arguing about a lot of tough issues, in the end, you have to get along with the people. And Rehnquist, I think, has done a very good job that he doesn't allow any of the legal disputes to become real personal animosities. You never hear among any of the justices about so-and-so hates somebody else, and there's not a lot of backbiting and even maneuvering the way there was on the Burger Court in the late 70s. The Brethren, which came out in the late 70s, recounted a lot of the bitter infighting in the Supreme Court. I think there's very little of that now. There are legal disagreements, but Rehnquist is such a, as I say, sort of a down-to-earth and genial fellow that even though the justices, some of them disagree very strongly on legal matters, it doesn't become a bitter personal set of feuds among the justices.
Do you think there are any fundamental differences between Rehnquist and the new generation of conservatives on the court?
There's one difference that I noticed that I think it would be interesting to see how it plays out in the years ahead. I think the new, younger generation of conservatives is much more supporters of the freedom of speech. There was a time in the late 60s, for example, when freedom of speech seemed to be a liberal cause, the Vietnam protests and civil rights demonstrations, and conservatives talked about law and order. I think in the 1980s, when freedom of speech became more abortion picketers and protesting against communism in Eastern Europe, many of the young conservatives are ardent proponents of freedom of speech because I think they think their ideas are better and they should be heard. And Justice Scalia and Kennedy in particular are strong supporters of the freedom of speech, and that was seen most vividly in the flag-burning case. Scalia and Kennedy, who were Reagan's second and third appointees, provided the majority to strike down the flag-burning laws on the grounds that this was a type of political protest. It was an act of political protest and therefore an act of free speech to stand up, let's say, on the steps of a city hall and burn a flag. Rehnquist took his more characteristic view of saying there's nothing in the Constitution that forbids this. A flag is a sacred symbol for many Americans. Millions of American soldiers have died for the flag, and Congress and the states certainly have the power to make it a crime to burn a flag.
Let me paraphrase something that you say in your book. You say that Thurgood Marshall and William Brennan were the last liberals. Now the most liberal members are Harry Blackmun and John Paul Stevens, both moderate Republicans. So how moderate or liberal are they?
Got something of, in the eye of the beholder. When they came on the court in the early 70s, Blackmun in 1970 and Stevens in 1975, they were seen as part of the Nixon-Ford court of being, for example, more conservative on crime. One of the big issues in the Stevens confirmation in 1975 is, was the death penalty unconstitutional? Stevens was willing to uphold the death penalty, as was Blackmun, at least as a matter of principle, and so therefore they were seen as moderate conservatives. But they were also strong supporters of the right to abortion. Blackmun, as you know, was the author of the Roe decision, and Stevens has also been a strong proponent of that right. So these days, they are viewed as, you know, as part of the liberal left wing of the court.
Mm-hmm. Where do you see Sandra Day O'Connor fitting in politically into the Rehnquist court?
She is, I would say, again, something of a moderate conservative. She's not with Rehnquist and Scalia as being a sort of an ideological, consistent conservative on every issue. Sandra O'Connor is a little bit like Lewis Powell, the justice who retired in 1987, is that she finds many of these cases very difficult and agonizes over them and doesn't say it's either black or white. She tends to write opinions that, for example, she would, on the religion area, she would allow more religion in public life. I think, for example, she would allow the creche on the in the city park as a Christmas display. She would not say, "Oh, you can't do that because it's a religious symbol." But she would certainly not go as far as the Chief Justice would and allow prayer in schools, because she said, "Once you cross the line where the government is endorsing religion, you're going too far. The government may not endorse religion." So she, more than any member of this current court, tends to draw a very fine line. She sort of finds a middle position and sticks to it, but she's not easily put into one camp or the other. I think you may have heard, there's always been a lot of discussion on her view on the abortion issue. She's the one member of the court who would join the conservatives to say that states may regulate abortion, for example, that they may impose a 24-hour waiting period or something of that sort. But she will not join the conservatives, I would predict, in allowing Roe versus Wade to be overturned entirely and saying states may make abortion a crime. She's tried to draw sort of a middle position that states may regulate, but they may not ban abortion.
Justice Scalia has accused her of being political in the way that she's made some of her decisions, particularly some of her decisions about abortion. Well, what does he mean by that?
Well, Scalia, I think, is very much the view that that the law is an intellectual exercise, that the Supreme Court should draw clear lines. It's either right or wrong. Either, for example, that the Supreme Court has the power to regulate abortion and pass all kinds of regulations, or it has no power at all. And Scalia says it has no power at all. The Supreme Court has no authority to touch the issue of abortion. It's a black and white issue for him. You know, he will frequently say, it's not a matter of justice, it's not a matter of what I think is right or wrong, it's a matter of what the law says. And he's very much a black and white, right or wrong. And he finds him, he constantly clashes with Justice O'Connor, and a lot of us are intrigued by that, because she, too, has fairly conservative views, moderate conservative views, but she doesn't see these issues as black and white, yes or no. she tends to, as I said, to write opinions that are more moderated, that draw a finer line, that said maybe yes in some situations, maybe no in others. And that, for some reason, really irritates Scalia.
Where do you see Clarence Thomas fitting in within the political spectrum represented on the Supreme Court?
So far, all we know is that he's very far on the right. He's written several decisions that have been, several concurring opinions that have been to the right of Chief Justice Rehnquist, which I think is means he's fairly conservative. But I will say, you know, he's very young. He's only 43 years old, and it'll be interesting to see whether he changes or evolves over time. I think he doesn't have a very clear, well-thought-out view of the law, but he did state fairly conservative views when he was in the Reagan and Bush administrations, and he was very badly hurt, I think, by all the attacks on him during the confirmation hearings, and most of his clerks that have gone to work for him are young conservatives. So he's, at this point, only, from what I understand, only hearing one side of a lot of issues.
Do you have any idea what the arguments between the justices are like now, what the dynamics are between the justices on the abortion issue?
Well, I don't, because it's behind closed doors, but I will say I've been surprised when I've talked to them before how little they argue about these issues. I've talked to some of the justices who have been there for a long time, and I said, well, what do you think, where do you think Justice O'Connor will come down in the end? And some of them who sat around the table with her for 15 years say, I really don't know. We talk about these in a fairly brief, narrow discussion. We make our points and then move on. They cast their votes. And so I think you might be surprised if you were able to put a microphone in that conference room that they are not either prolonged arguments or deep debates. Scalia complains about this a lot. They tend to go, each of them takes 30 seconds or a minute to announce his view of the case, and here's how I'm going to vote. They go around and they count up the votes, and that's how it is. They don't sit at the table and argue back and forth with each other.
When you look at the Supreme Court and at the future of American laws interpreted by the Supreme Court, are you worried by what you see?
Well, I suppose I could be worried in the sense of, I think it's fairly clear what the direction of this Supreme Court is. It's not clear what the destination is. What I mean by that is that this court is inclined to give prosecutors, police, government officials more power. And I suppose I do worry sometimes, where does that stop? For example, last year they upheld a search and seizure of a person traveling on a Greyhound bus. The police got on the bus down in Fort Lauderdale and walked down the aisles and asked everybody to look in their bags and try to find drugs. And the court upheld that. Well, what would you think if the police in the town you lived in came into the restaurants routinely and said, I want everybody to stand up and I'd like to look through your purses and bags and wallets? Or they did that on airplane aisles. You know, where does that stop? And I think the concern I have for the future is whether this court will at some point in those areas say, the police can't go any further than this and prosecutors can't do this. That goes too far. That would be fundamentally unfair. It'll be an interesting thing to see in the next 5 years whether this court is willing to draw some lines and say, okay, we're going to give the police more authority than before, but this is as far as they can go. They can't go beyond this.
David Savage, I want to thank you a lot for talking with us.
Well, thank you, Terry. Enjoy it.
David Savage covers the Supreme Court for the Los Angeles Times and has written a new book called Turning Right, The Making of the Rehnquist Supreme Court. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
From Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. Aram Saroyan was writing one-word poems in the 60s. Literary form wasn't the only thing he was experimenting with. Coming up, we talk about his new memoir of the 60s, and we discuss his earlier memoir about his father, the late writer William Saroyan, whose private life was just about the opposite of his public image. Also, Ken Tucker reviews two hip-hop hits, Ain't Too Proud to Beg, an old title with a new feminist message, and Jump, performed by two guys wearing their clothes backwards. That's all coming up on Fresh Air.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Ann Taylor. The State Department touched off a controversy in Israel yesterday when it repeated U.S. support for a 43-year-old U.N. resolution. And today, U.S. officials tried to calm things down. NPR's Ted Clark reports.
Resolution 194 says Palestinians should be permitted to return to homes they once occupied in what is now Israel. Many Israelis fear if that happened, the Jewish state would be flooded with Arab refugees and would cease to exist. The Israeli government asked the State Department for an explanation. Today, spokeswoman Margaret Tutwiler said the U.S. was not insisting on the right of Palestinians to return. That can only be resolved, she said, through direct bilateral negotiations between the parties themselves.
What they determine through their negotiations is what matters.
Tutwiler said this issue should not be discussed in the multilateral talks on Mideast refugees now underway in Ottawa. Israel is boycotting those talks. This is Ted Clark in Washington.
Three astronauts are now taking part in a spacewalk in a third effort to capture a stranded communications satellite. Two earlier efforts failed, and so now the three astronauts will try to snare the satellite by hand, now planned for a little over 1 hour from now. However, this latest try was delayed earlier because of a computer problem. It's the first time ever that three men have been in space at the same time, because it's felt that more than two complicates the mission. In Czechoslovakia, campaigns are underway for elections to parliament in a tense climate concerning the possible breakup of the federation's two republics. NPR's Sylvia Pajoli reports from Prague.
On June 5th, Czechs and Slovaks will be going to the polls for the second free election since the fall of communism in 1989. But the euphoria of the Velvet Revolution has dimmed, and the country is now undergoing the hardships of economic reform and mounting polarization between the Czech and Slovak republics. In the Czech Republic, the frontrunner is the Civic Democratic Party, which is promoting radical economic reform. Preliminary polls in Slovakia, the poorer and more rural area, give pro-separation nationalists one-third of the vote. And all Slovak parties want a much slower pace in transforming the state-run economy into a free market. In a pre-election speech, President Václav Havel, a Czech, said that if a split is inevitable, he hoped it could come about in a peaceful and constitutional manner rather than in a Yugoslavia-style chaos. This is Sylvia Poggioli in Prague.
In New York City on Wall Street, the Dow Jones Industrials moved up nearly 7 points to close at 3,391.98 on volume of 172 million shares. Advancing and declining issues closed just about even. This is NPR News. New York City UN Secretary General Boutros Boutros-Ghali said today that there will be no peacekeeping units sent to Bosnia because of continued violence there. He also says that factional fighting is a danger to some 10,000 peacekeepers now in Croatia. A basic principle of UN peacekeeping is that there must be agreement on a ceasefire by all parties involved. The Secretary General says the Federal Army and Serbian factions are going their own way, despite peace agreements, and charged that the Serbian population of Bosnia is mainly responsible for the violence in that state. The president of Chile is now in Washington for talks with high-level U.S. officials. Under consideration is the possibility of opening talks concerning a free trade agreement. NPR's Richard Gonzalez reports.
Patricio Aylwin is the first Chilean president to visit the United States in 30 years. Chile's economy is growing at an average rate of 6% since 1985. Both Aylwin and the Bush administration would like to begin negotiations towards a free trade pact on a fast-track basis. Mr. Bush, in his welcoming remarks this morning, made his plans clear.
The United States and Chile are two of the world's foremost proponents of free trade, and we look forward to working with you to expand bilateral and global trade as rapidly as possible.
But the administration will need Congress's approval, and lawmakers are sensitive because of the still uncompleted free trade talks with Mexico. In a statement, the White House said free trade negotiations will begin upon completion of the North American Free Trade Agreement. I'm Richard Gonzalez at the White House.
Former Soviet President Gorbachev and former President Reagan were visitors at the New York Stock Exchange this morning, and they were cheered and applauded by hundreds of traders. One trader shouted at Gorbachev, "Thank you for everything." Before touring the floor, Gorbachev met with the heads of numerous U.S. companies. This is NPR News in Washington.
This is Fresh Air. Aram Saroyan's early writing would never be mistaken for that of his famous father, William Saroyan. William was best known for his works about family life, like The Time of Your Life and The Human Comedy. Aram started off writing one-word poems, but when he turned to prose, his family was often the subject. In his book Last Rites about the death of his father, Aram described a man totally unlike his public image. Aram wrote, "My father never liked me or my sister, and he never liked our mother either after an initial infatuation. In fact, he never liked anyone at all after an hour or two. No one except a stooge." Aram's parents got married and divorced twice by the time he was 8. His mother, Carol, has been married to Walter Matthau for the past 30 years. In the book Trio, Aram wrote about his mother and her celebrated friends Una Chaplin and Gloria Vanderbilt. His new book is about his own life and his coming of age as a writer in the 60s. It's called Friends in the World, The Education of a Writer. Here's Aram Saroyan reading an excerpt.
I grew up in the last generation for whom writers and poets were the genuine culture heroes. The corner paperback rack in a New York City drugstore was likely to contain serious literature in those days before the takeover of the mega book. Then in high school, the phenomenon of the Beat Generation occurred, echoed in England by the novelists and playwrights known as the Angry Young Men. There wasn't a serious contemporary I knew who wasn't engaged by all this. The idea of being a writer in the late 50s or early 60s was as engaging a possibility, if in the end a less likely one, as being a rock musician is today. And we looked to our poets and novelists much as kids today look to their rock stars for the truth about life. As the child of a broken marriage, troubled by having a famous father with a public image that seemed the opposite of his private reality, I was in search of some kind of fundamental understanding upon which to base my own development. I had an uneasy sense of being estranged not only from the reality around me, but from my own deeper reality as well. The situation now seems to me to have had much to do with my being the child of a public figure and wanting to be in consensus with the public's view of my father. It was a classic double bind. If I accepted the reality of my father as I knew him, I had to do battle with the whole public perception of who he was. If, on the other hand, I tried to agree with the public perception of my parent, I would have to close off my own actual knowledge of who he was and, by extension, who I myself was. I turned to writing then as a possible means of coming to grips with the emotional confusion of my situation.
That's Aram Saroyan reading from his new memoir, Friends in the World, The Education of a Writer. Now, you say that you turned to writing as a possible means of coming to grips with the emotional confusion of your situation. But the writing you first became known for were your minimalist poems that were often only one word in length. So it was hardly this kind of, you know, expository narrative where you sorted through the emotional confusion of your life.
Well, you know, that was one of the interesting things that happened during the 60s. Here I was, the kid, the son of a famous writer, and coming out of a kind of a very rarefied scene and probably slated to be standing in those shadows forever, except that the 60s happened. And suddenly my generation was what was really going on. It was a wonderful kind of liberation from all of that familial baggage. The poem L-I-G-H-G-H-T was chosen by Robert Duncan for an NEA award in 1967 and then became the subject of ongoing decades-long controversy. Because a congressman brought it up on the floor of Congress and said, this is a misuse of public funds. I was given $500, and the Chicago Review that printed the poem was given $250. That poem is, I think, briefly could be described as a reflection in a literary form of the whole stop-time reality that we knew during the 60s.
Let me stop you here to explain that the poem, it's one word, and it's a misspelling of the word light. And it's
That's
spelled,
right. It has an extra G-H in it.
Right, so it's L-I-G-H-G-H-T. So why did you write the poem? What did it mean to you when you wrote it?
I think it meant that during the 60s, what happened was space got a little bit fatter. Time kind of slowed down, at least for my generation. And if you look at Warhol in painting or Donald Judd in sculpture and some of the serial kind of stuff that was going on in music at the time, this is really falls right in line with it. I think literature is the most conservative art form, so it was very, it was upsetting and a little shocking. As a literary form, more so than it would have been as if I had done it, for instance, just as a poster.
So were you able to give poetry readings with one-word poems like that?
Sure. Haven't you heard me read crickets?
No, I haven't.
Crickets, 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 crickets.
Now, you were often writing while high, right? And I was wondering if the drug experience affected the kind of writing
that
you were
was
doing.
That would happen. It wasn't primary. It wasn't an absolutely necessary part of the process of composition. What would happen was I would go through phases with marijuana specifically, where I would sometimes use it as part of the process of composition. I would smoke. What happened to me ultimately was the reason I stopped smoking marijuana was because I found that there were certain things that I wanted to do as a writer that were absolutely impossible using marijuana, things like writing narrative prose.
Mm-hmm.
But at the same time, for a young man as I was, as tense as I was, as kind of burdened with all this extra parental type of historical baggage, it was liberating for a moment, and I learned something from it. I think Norman Mailer says, whatever you get out of it, it's a trade-off. You know, you lose something as well. I stopped. I experimented for, let's say, periods of 2 to 3 months, and then would stop, and then do it again. And what I found was that as I went along, it became less and less useful to me.
My guest is Aram Saroyan. He's written a memoir about his development as a writer in the 60s. It's called Friends in the World. More after this short break. This is Fresh Air. Writer Aram Saroyan is my guest. When you stopped writing minimalist poetry, one of the subjects that you wrote about and continued to write about was family, your own mm-hmm. family, you know, your wife and your child and then children, and then the family that you were born into, your father and mm-hmm. and your mother and your mother's mm-hmm. friends. mm-hmm. Tell me mm-hmm. why writing about family has been such a central subject to you over the years.
I know for my father, the idea of a family was absolutely one of the deepest ambitions of his life, and the fact that it failed in his life was I think maybe the deepest disappointment for him. And he just kind of passed that on to me. He said, you know, geez, this is what it's all about, you know. And I was lucky enough to meet my wife, Galen, in 1967 and find a partner, someone that I could really move through the world with. And we began a family in 1970. And in a way, it was a kind of passage out of the 60s. It was, you know, a kind of crash course in the here and now. And at the same time, when you do have a family, I think when you have children, your own parents' struggle and your grandparents' struggle comes clearer, comes into a kind of relief. But, you know, essentially the book that began my writing about my own family was Last Rites, which was a journal I kept when my father was dying of cancer during April and May of 1981. And what that was for me was essentially naming and then setting down a lot of the baggage that I'd had growing up as the son of a famous writer who actually was a very complicated, interesting, very human guy, not at all the literary Santa Claus that he was essentially portrayed as in the media.
Your mother has a forthcoming memoir, and
right.
I've just been paging through the galleys of it. I haven't had a chance to read the whole thing, but mm-hmm. I've read that you're not mentioned at all in the memoir, that her mm-hmm. two children with William Saroyan aren't mentioned in it, and I wonder how you feel about that.
You know, that's a whole other story, and I've kind of maintained a kind of no comment posture at this point, which I believe is the way for me to go. She has a book coming out. I think it's good for people to see the book. Read the book, read the excerpts, and, you know, I'm a writer. Ultimately, I will, I'll be, there's more on it, but I don't think this is the time for me to comment on it.
Mm-hmm. When you were younger, one of the things you wanted to do was to start a press, a small publishing company that would be to its generation what Lawrence Ferlinghetti's company City Lights was to his. How close do you feel that you came to that?
We didn't get too close, but we did publish a series of eight or nine pocket poet standardized format books, including Patti Smith's first book, books by Gerard Malanga and Tom Weatherly and Ron Padgett and Tom Clark and Ted Berrigan, and we had a good time, and it was a kind of a communal event within our circle of writers.
What do you think is left for you of that sense of a generational connection?
Well, I'm 2 years shy of 50, and I believe that the 60s, per se, is misrepresented, trivialized, and in certain ways obliterated in our history. We have a habit of doing that, and it was an extraordinary period, a period of idealism and communalism, where really what you had was not a political revolution, but a cultural revolution. And, I'm real proud to have been a part of it, and I'm now using it as a writer. It's odd. It's paradoxical. You write a book about the 60s because essentially we're talking about a time where we thought we'd come to the end of history as we'd known it. And to now be writing about it and using it as like an historical resource is paradoxical.
In the early 80s, you moved from Bolinas, which you described as a stronghold of literary bohemia, into the geography of the American middle class, Ridgefield, Connecticut. I believe you've moved back to California since then. Where do you feel like you most belong physically now?
My own sense is that my childhood was bicoastal, and I am, most of my books have bicoastal settings, but I feel closest where I'm living now in Southern California. I feel the most at home as that I've ever felt.
Mm-hmm. Do you feel like you're still a part of a literary bohemia?
I feel loyalty to the spirit of that time. I feel, for instance, that there's a terrible backlash going on right now in poetry, where you really have you don't see the writers of my generation of that 60s period in the anthologies at all, and it's not because they're not accomplished writers, I regret that, because what's happened with poetry is that very few people read it anymore, and it's hard to remember that during the late 60s there was a huge audience for poetry, and it was because these writers wrote for the larger audience and the larger world, and that's something we need, and I'm sorry that it's not out there the way it should be.
I want to thank you very much for talking with us.
Thank you.
Aram Saroyan's new memoir, Friends in the World, The Education of a Writer, is published by Coffee House Press. This is Fresh Air. Linda Wertheimer's with us. Let's see what's coming up on All Things Considered. Linda, will you be covering the spacewalk?
Terry, Michael Scholar, our science correspondent, is watching that story. Three astronauts walk in space for the first time to try to rescue an errant satellite. We also will be watching big city mayors in Washington to talk to the Congress and to the president about city policy and rescuing the cities. We'll have a piece on Ross Perot. He pictures himself as the outsider who is not like Washington, but he can behave like a Washington insider, and we'll have a story on that. And as you know, we love Bulgarian music, so I'll have a piece on Bulgarian wedding music.
Thanks, Linda. That and more on All Things Considered from National Public Radio. Lots of rap music is harshly realistic and serious, but two of the most popular new young acts managed to make topical points while maintaining a sense of humor. Rock critic Ken Tucker has a review of the debut albums by TLC and Criss Cross.
Shower and I knew I was late. Stepped out, put on my jeans and my U, and said to myself, if I miss school, I'm ruined. I ran down a hill and I rush.
In its second week on the Billboard record chart, the debut album by Criss Cross, Totally Crossed Out, vaulted ahead of Wynonna Judd and one of Bruce Springsteen's new albums to take the number three position. By itself, this achievement doesn't mean much. Lots of junk hits the top of the charts. But in the case of the rap duo Criss Cross, it's pretty cool, because these two Atlanta kids, Chris Kelly and Chris Smith, are just 12 and 13 years old, and yet they've come up with one of the year's most well-thought-out hip-hop records.
Because inside out, it's wiggity, 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 whack. I come stomping with something pumping to keep you jumping. R&B, rapping, bull crap is what I'm dumping. Ain't nothing soft about Criss Cross, we all at. So when the eggs do they rock, say believe that.
Jump, jump.
The Mac Dad will make ya.
Jump, jump.
A Daddy Mac will make ya.
Jump, jump.
Criss Cross will make ya.
Jump, jump.
That's Jump, the number one single in the country right now. Unlike most child acts, it doesn't look as if Criss Cross is being masterminded by some middle-aged Svengali. They write their own music, and before acquiring a manager and a record label deal, they'd established their own visual style. They wear their clothes backwards, shirts, pants, hats twisted around 180 degrees. It's a bit of fashion aggression that a number of newspapers have already reported is catching on. Watch for it on a street corner near you. The other hot hip-hop act right now is TLC, a female trio whose concerns are a bit more mature than Criss Cross's, but no less intricately clever. Playfully aggressive yet seriously feminist, TLC doesn't waste any tender loving care on guys who mistreat them. I Can Be Bad By Myself is only one of their forthright tips to men on their debut album called Ooh on the TLC Tip. TLC is PC. These women rap about safe sex, and in a sense, they embody it. Their stage costumes are covered with condoms, and the TLC member who calls herself Left Eye frequently wears a condom over her left eye, like a rather limp eye patch. But quite aside from the group's jaunty attitude and precise rhymes, the messages in this music are strong ones. Nowhere is this more true than on His Story, the pop song that was waiting to be written about women whose accusations of sexual abuse are discredited by the men they accuse. Anita Hill and Patricia Bowman are implied, and Tawana Brawley is mentioned by name. Sometimes I feel like there is no reason for me to explain. No matter how much we complain, you know it all stays the same. They try to call us freaks. Why does it have to be? We can't get justified until we speak up. This is the story of a man. By the way, if you were wondering, I'm as susceptible to trends as the next guy. I am doing this review with all of my clothes on backwards. As for TLC's condom fetish, well, none of your darn business.
Ken Tucker writes about popular culture for Entertainment Weekly. Our program was directed by Sue Spolin. I'm Terry Gross.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
On the next Fresh Air, Cambodia, before and after the UN peace agreement. We'll talk with Stan Sesser, who writes about Cambodia in the current issue of The New Yorker. Also, a talk with actress Christine Lottie. I'm Terry Gross. I hope you'll join us for the next Fresh Air.